Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. My name is Matt Hudson from What I Watch Tonight, and joining me from across the pond, he's a statesman to my kingsman, and I'd like to preserve him for future generations. It's John Burke from Burke Reviews. How are you, sir?
It's funny how things come full circle, sir, because we had phased the Kingsman thing out, and I think we're bringing it back. Maybe that's a sign that the fourth movie is going to happen. Even though the third movie, I don't think did very well, if I remember correctly.
Was that the King's Man?
The King's Man, which are obviously, they were setting up more. Yeah. And I'm down for it. I've enjoyed all three. I don't think they're all, you know, masterpieces or anything, but we're not here to talk about Kingsman. What am I doing? What is happening?
Well, I want to know, how are you doing though, my friend? How is Florida? Are you keeping it safe and well?
It's weird weather week. It was hot last week and it's starting to get cold again. And today was warm, but tonight's supposed to drop into the 40s. So we're just in this weird, like, up and down wave of weather here. We're working and, I've been getting prepped, for my non-IB film classes. We're going to be, one class is covering musicals. And one class is covering sci-fi, and I haven't done genre in this formal style for a couple of years. We used to do that. That was always the structure of the class before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic happened and half of our students were at home, it created a problem because I didn't have access to my full film library.
Yeah.
I was just kind of doing movie by movie, but now I decided to dive back into genre. I like the organization of it. I think it's fun, the projects we get to do out of it. And man, I got to say, I really love pushing my students to accept musicals because when I was their age, I hated musicals. And honestly, pretty much until I started Burke Reviews, I had the attitude that musicals weren't for me. And I've really come full circle on that where I've, no, there's musicals for everybody. You just have to find the ones that do work. And so I was working on like a slideshow and then I got three new really big bookshelves in my classroom yesterday to expand Burke Buster a little bit. It was getting a little tight. We had movies like stacked in front of each other where you couldn't really shop it. So I got bigger bookshelves. I got all my movie books that students can check out also, like, you know, about filmmaking, about cinematography, that kind of stuff, including Quentin Tarantino's film book that came out last year, Cinema Speculations. I got a couple of copies of that on the shelf. So I was like moving stuff around today, like finishing putting stuff on the new shelves. And I just like threw the La La Land soundtrack on. And it was just, sometimes I wish we could be like musicals where we could just dance, you know, and no one would think like, oh, whatever, they're weird, they're dancing. Because
it's been a dream of mine to meet you and do that, John, like they do in the planetarium in that film. We'll just float off.
Yes, float into outer space. but that's what I've been kind of like focused on this week was getting those PowerPoints ready. And it's been a lot of fun exploring. I ended up with the genre analysis too. I started using La La Land as a breakdown because it's such a great example of a student of film making a genre film. Like it's Damien Chazelle really showcasing the musical genre, especially the MGM musicals from that time period of the 50s that he's, you know, calling back to. And it just breaks down so perfectly into the genre elements that it was very easy to like pull images. Like, here's the protagonist, here's the female protagonist. There isn't like really truly an antagonist. It's their own, they're in their own way, you know, and Hollywood is in their way. I mean, obviously, if you've seen La La Land, it ends differently than those classic musicals would traditionally end, which is why some people don't like it, but they're wrong. So
get that wrong.
I'm a big fan of that. I love the songs in it. I'm not sure if I'm going to teach it. I'm dabbling with some stuff. I showed them the opening 8-minute dance number from West Side Story, the 1961 West Side Story. And then we talked about the problematic nature of Natalie Wood being the Puerto Rican character. But that, you know, and then how Spielberg has you know, righted the ship a little bit with that. He's cast correctly. We didn't have people in brownface in the new version of West Side Story, but I was surprised because a lot of them were very like, I literally had a student come up to me and like beg me to not do musicals on Monday when we start Tuesday when we started talking about it. But then today I caught wind because they play basketball for a few seconds in that scene and there's no singing in that opening number, right? It's just them dancing. And I think they were more open to the dancing, especially because they're like, they're fight dancing. You know, it's like, I think I might have at least convinced them that you may not like everything we watch, but there are going to be musicals that you will like if you give it a chance. And that's my thesis. It's not that you're going to like every musical, but that somewhere in that genre, there is one that you will enjoy. And that's all we have to do is figure out which ones.
It's genre, isn't it? How much I love the horror genre, but it doesn't mean I love every single film in it or even every single subgenre of the genre. For example, we're talking about Skin and Marink last week and the week before, how, you know, I couldn't, you know, I appreciated it for what it is, but I can't sit there and watch that all day, every day, that kind of stuff, man. And there are other, you know, subgenres within that, which I naturally gravitate to. Same as in something like sci-fi, same as in action. There are certain things that personally I look for, which I'll always go towards. And musicals, I remember when I found out La La Land was a musical, I was off the radar when La La Land really came out. I didn't really look to know too much about it other than people were really, really loving it. I knew there was a song and dance here and there. But when it opened with Another Day of Sun on the I-95 or wherever they are in LA, I thought, oh no. Oh no, this is very kind of Broadway, West End, very theatrical, very la 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 la. I thought, I can't be, what have I done? But then the movie hit, like everything everywhere for you, the movie entered my top five of all time on the strength of everything within it, including the songs, including the dancing, because it all just felt so right. So it pains me that little bit to hear you say you may not teach it, but I get your reasons why, and I sit here every week thinking, I think you need to teach it again, John, just so you can watch it again.
And I might. I'm teaching about it.
It's a very good example of a modern musical, isn't it? Even though it pays homage.
One of the things that I like to do with my classes is I try to find their entry point, and I don't know if mm-hmm. La La Land might be too, like, I think the genre of music can't go too classic. I think mm-hmm. it needs to be a little more poppy or a little more, like, I'm avoiding the jukebox musicals as much as possible. I'm thinking I might be leaning into like In the Heights to get mm-hmm. a little bit of the Lin-Manuel built into that. Mm-hmm. A musical that many people haven't seen that Big Tuna turned me onto is called Stuck.
I haven't seen that one.
It's a very diverse cast. It's one of the things I really like about it. And it's about the interactions of these different types of people. Like there's a homeless man who's played by Giancarlo Esposito, who I always love to see, especially singing. He is wild in this movie. Ashanti plays the middle-aged type character, which is interesting because I've known Ashanti as a musician for a long time. It's a kind of eclectic musical. It's not perfect, but I really like it. And I like the music is all over the place genre wise. There's even a character who's Hispanic, and I believe his song is predominantly in Spanish. So I like that. Like I like the ability to include as many of my student styles into the movie as possible. And it's only 90 minutes, which is always, you know, as we talk about on the show, way too long. We like a 90 minute film, you know, it's hard not to, unless it's bad.
As long as it's a good one.
We don't like it. Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's got to be a good film. Well, thankfully, tonight we are talking about a musical film. Musical you mean a science fiction thriller set in a dystopian future, then yeah, we are. Of course, we're not talking about a musical. For those who are new to the show, firstly, welcome. Each week we drop a non-spoiler review of the week's biggest or most interesting release. January's been quite sparse and it will continue to be so. So we're throwing out some interesting bones over the next few weeks. And this week, we're going to drop our review of the Netflix original Zheng Yi. Now, we're not going to drop spoilers in the episode, but we are going to discuss the movie slightly more in depth than we usually would do. Fear not, though, we're not going to spoil the big reveals. We're not going to spoil the third act, but we're not going to be doing our usual spoiler episode on Monday. So do bear that in mind if you haven't seen the film. This one's just over an hour and 30. It's an hour and 39 minutes, so it's not too bad. But this is Zheng Yi, then. It's directed and written by Yeon Sang-ho, of course, of Train to Busan and Peninsula fame. And it stars Lee Dong-hee as the chairman in her final role before she passed away, Kang Soo-yun as Yun So-hyun, Kim Hyun-joo as Zheng Yi, Am Ji-won as Lee Si-yun, and Ryu Kyung-soo as Sang-hoon. The film was actually dedicated to Kang Soo-yun as well. She passed away in real life just after they'd finished filming this.
Because of cancer? Or?
I believe it was a cardiac arrest, just from reading up about it.
I didn't know that detail. Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, no, because when I saw the film was in tribute to this performer, when I was watching, I wasn't kind of tuned into who it was at first. And I noticed that I think they were born in like 1966. And I thought, wow, that's no age at all. So I quickly Googled, got it up, and I was like, oh, wow, that was our kind of lead actress in this film, which is very sad news to hear. Again, 1966 birth, that's no age. That's what, 56 years old, coming on 57. That's no age. And I know that she was scary. A very respected actress in the Korean film industry as well. So, okay, so we don't give spoilers, like I say, but we do read the synopsis, which says, on an uninhabitable 22nd century Earth, the outcome of a civil war hinges on cloning the brain of an elite soldier to create a robot mercenary. So we're going forward in time here. Now, how do critics and the fans see this film? It's a Netflix film, which almost comes with a stigma attached to it. John, currently on Rotten Tomatoes, the critics have this at 60%, 60%. And the audience, not far off, 64% audience score. Okay, so we're pretty standard across the board then. But how about this? 53 Metascore, 5.4 IMDb user score, and 2.6 on Letterboxd. 2.6 out of 5. You double that to make it out of 10, that's 5.2. So we're kind of pretty much across the board. People are giving this 5 to 6 as a consensus. As we mentioned, this film is only available on Netflix. So if you have a Netflix subscription, you can watch Zhang Yi for free.
I feel like I may have zoned out if you said this, and apologies if you did, but did we mention who the director, his other work?
Yes, sir, we did.
Okay, I failed so hard. I apologize.
My friend, it's totally fine. Obviously, Yun San-ho with the masterful Train to Busan, one of the great zombie films of the lot, and then came back with Peninsula, which for me wasn't. But obviously looking through his filmography, and in preparation for this, I've seen a lot of people starting to think now that Train to Busan was a bit of a fluke. Now, what did we think about Zhang Yi? I looked at the budget for this. It's, in terms of dollars, it's a $16 million budget film. I actually thought it was going to be higher than that. And at times, the film looks like it's got a $16 million budget. The film, I think, straight up the top, I think the film is good. I think the film is fine. It's good. It borrows from a lot of other films that potentially do this scenario a little bit better. You think Ex Machina, think Ghost in the Shell, obviously Blade Runner, Altered Carbon, the Terminator. Throw all those into a blender and you kind of come out with Zhang Yi. Now, again, I think it's a fine film. I think it struggles somewhat with its own story and how far Yun San-ho actually wants to go with this. A lot of the issues within it, I found, were quite surface level in terms of how they dealt with them. Now, that's not to say that the film doesn't have its moments, because there's one moment in this especially, but I can think of two more so, that Yun San-ho, if anyone has seen Train to Busan, you know when he gets that emotional, when everything falls into place, he can hit you right where it hurts. And there are two moments in this film where I think he does that very, very well, actually. But in and around that, there are moments which I thought, or characters, which I thought, he just seems a bit OTT. And I'm looking at you, Lee Dong, he is chairman. He's a director, sorry. I'm talking about, Ryu Kyung-soo as Sang-hoon, the director. I was like, I get it. I get what you're doing. It started off okay, but he never quite dropped the shtick of who he was. We find out later on a little bit more about why that is. But there's some interesting kind of hypotheticals that the film raises. I just don't think it goes into it as far as it could do. We're talking about human identity here. We're talking about, obviously, looking forward. We're talking about cloning. We're talking about independence and what do you own. And also, we're looking at big corporations and how bad the big corporations are, and you're selling yourselves to them. And as I mentioned, you've seen other films like Ghost in the Shell do this. And they do it better, I think. But there is some drama within this. And I think that Yun San-ho does very well at times to weave that drama in. It just sometimes feels like we've got the drama facing off against the action in this. Now, we mentioned that the They're trying to clone the brain of an elite soldier. So we're going to get some action scenes. The film opens up with an action scene, which is probably one of the better scenes in the film. And then we kind of get action spliced throughout. And at times it actually drags the film down, especially in the middle with a second of the three acts. I think this film suffers quite badly from some pacing issues and some repetition as well. But so it's fighting against itself with the Edwards. Does it want to be an action film, a sci-fi film?
Yeah.
Does it want to be this, I can't think of the word, but it's a big long word, but talking about existentialism, or does it want to be a drama? You know, individually, some parts of each bit has some good moments, but it doesn't come together enough for me, John, in this film. It's not a bad film. I'm going to say that right now. This isn't a film which I watched and thought, God almighty, this is bad. This is a film I watched and thought, I appreciate it. I like what you're doing here, but if I want to see it done in a more elevated way or a better way, I'm going to go and watch one of those five or six films or television shows that I've seen earlier on. It's just not very original. It feels Netflixy, and it has all the vibes of a Netflix film, but I didn't dislike it, John. Is this the part now where you say you hated it?
No, actually, I think you pretty much express exactly how I feel. I gave it 3 out of 5 on Letterboxd. And
I think I'd be with you there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you could go a half a star either way. Like, I could go up a half a star, go down half a star. You actually made me kind of reevaluate something. Sometimes I fall for, I really like this idea that you present, but then forget that they don't do anything with it outside of present it. And I was I'm going to talk about it actually right now. They present this idea of three different basically insurance levels of saving your brain. There's the A class, which you get full human rights. So your android body, you have full autonomy over it. Like your brain, your human brain will be digitized and put into an AI android body, and you will basically just get to keep on living as a human, even though you're an android. But that's expensive. And then they have tier B, and tier B is you have less rights, but still mostly have some human rights and some rules that you can follow. Mm-hmm. But then the free option, C, is some company owns it, and they can do whatever they want with it. They can make replicants. They can, you know, not of you. So, like, there could be a million of you, and you have no rights. You are essentially a slave. I thought that it was a really cool concept.
Yep.
But it kind of ends there. Like, it does tie into other moments in the plot, but that should be the focus of this movie, is this class kind of division. Because there's clearly, you could get into like class warfare type situations where, you know, the wealthy elite are going to have autonomy. They're going to be able to do whatever they want, while most of us, who maybe we don't want to like not live forever, we want our consciousness to continue going, would be stuck with that free option. And of course, there's others who maybe wouldn't even want any of those options. But
it's the moral issue of it as well, which comes into it, which isn't really defined or explored.
Well, especially that C. It's almost indentured servant type situation with that C class, because they can create a version of you that is, you know, for sale and things like that. And it doesn't go deep enough with the ethics of it. And that's what sci-fi is supposed to do. Now, sci-fi action, which is, this is that hybrid genre, it's definitely more concerned with being an action movie. And that, I don't think the action looks bad, especially because this is a Netflix movie. It's all CG, listeners. That's the important thing. And I think that's wearing on me as like movies. Like, I love good hand-to-hand combat movies, and it's just never as good with a CG scenario, because it can't be, like, it just can't be. Maybe with like a James Cameron level motion capture Avatar, hand-to-hand combat can be that level of like great martial art movie. But like, when you look back at Train to Busan, I forget the actor's name, but I really, really like the one bigger guy in that movie, and he is an incredible action star. I've seen him in a couple of other Korean movies, and he's really good hand-to-hand combat. And there, even though I think a lot of the zombies in Train to Busan are CG, the ones he fights, I do not think are. I think those are like real people scenarios. And it just feels different than what you get in this scenario. And again, I don't have any real complaints about the action. I think it looks pretty good, considering it can't be like a Marvel. It looks better than some Marvel CG fights at times.
I'll give you that, yeah. And just to reiterate, it's a I worked it out via, I did some currency conversion, and I believe this comes in just around the $16 million mark for the budget.
Which, for a CG action movie, is pretty low, I would venture to say, by comparison to like a Marvel film, which is at least 120, I would, on average. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, I don't have any major complaints about the look of the film. It just still, like, I would prefer hand-to-hand combat. And it makes sense into the premise why it's not real people and why it's like robots and whatnot. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, but I also then, you could argue, I'd rather just have an animated film than a CG animated film.
It's a great show.
Which obviously, there's flaws with fighting in animation because you have to draw all of it and it takes even longer. So like, I don't know what I guess just real people I tend to like with that type of stuff.
But with animation, you can kind of, animation, we've all seen animated films, especially anime or from the studios from Japan, Korea, wherever. We know you can get away with a lot more in animation. You can be that bit more daring. And a lot of some of the best, you look at Ghost in the Shell, look how layered that film is. Look at the depth of which they explore their theme in that film, which is absolutely spectacular. Something which, to be fair, the Scarlett Johansson one didn't do a bad job of replicating. The film itself isn't anywhere near as good as that original, but I don't think it's as bad as the world gives it credit for. It's just a bit bland. But in animation, you can get away with a lot more, and I think that's a good point. I think if Zhang-Yi was an animated film, I think we look upon it maybe a little bit differently.
I think you're right. And again, it's, I do like this film. I think there's some good stuff in it. I like the two main characters. I like Kim Han Jo or Ju.
Yep,
Jo.
Zhang-Yi. I think she's very cool. I like her.
Yeah, I thought her performance was really good. Especially there are moments where her performance is like, I can't imagine what it would have been on set, because it's like she's like a bust at some point where it's just a head and shoulders.
Yeah.
And like so I don't know how, is she sitting in a chair? Is that just CG'd face and like, you know, voice acting? Like, I'm not sure what we're looking at, to be honest, but I thought the performance was really good.
Mm-hmm. I believe,
and as you said, Sang-ho really good at hitting those emotional beats and not feeling manipulative about it. Like when those emotional beats hit, you're like, oh guy, you did a good job getting that emotion there. I'm a bigger fan of Peninsula than a lot of other people, so I don't dislike this. I really love Train to Busan. Like, that's like masterclass movie. Absolutely. Peninsula, I had a lot of fun. It was Mad Max, Fast and Furious meets that emotional family thing. And then, you know, this is a little less, again, but interesting concepts here. I do wish, I think you were correct too when you said about the pacing. It feels like they're trying to get to the end, maybe because they're running out of dollars because they spent it all on the CG. but they don't miss the emotional beats. And I think that's what makes this watchable and not bad, is the story still solid. You just see where they cut things off that should have been developed more. Again, you mentioned the ethics. I won't get into specifics because I think that gets into the third act stuff. Mm-hmm, but there are things that are, they're like throwaway moments that should be like the heart or the meat of what this story is. Mm-hmm. And that's what's disappointing and why it's only like a 3-star movie and not a 5-star, because if this were Blade Runner or more to me, Blade Runner 2049, which does a better job than Blade Runner, in my opinion.
I'm with you there. Sorry, guys.
It just, you know, it lingers and it allows you to kind of chew on the repercussions of what the characters have done, and this movie does not have time for that. It's like, action, this thing
focuses
happening.
On its strengths more than kind of trying to be a jack of all trades, which I think this film is trying to do, where it's trying to include too much. I mean, in doing so, never really has time to explore any of them, whereas, like you said quite rightly, actually, if it focuses on that kind of class system, that tier system of your existence of when you pass, I think that would be an excellent thing to focus on, or just focus on the emotional core of this film and maybe cut back on some of the action. Because I went back and watched the trailer for this film, and the trailer looks like an action film, which is also not very helpful. And I don't really like comparing one film to another, which I started this review off with, but I think for a film like this, where it's not an original film. There's nothing unique about this film. It's very hard to not critique it against other films. And when there are films, like you mentioned with Blade Runner 2049, like I mentioned in The Ghost in the Shell, when those films exist and cover similar beats but do it so well with so much gravitas and weight and quality, it's hard not to look at something like Zhang Yi and think, yeah, you just don't stack up. And lest it be for me to tell Yun Sang-ho how to write a film or direct a film, I just think, like you pointed out, the focus was on the wrong areas. This could have been a much better film if they trimmed out some of that fat, if they got rid of some of that repetition that we saw in the middle and focused on some of that drama that he's so good at eliciting from his actors and from the moments. This film's got some good moments in it. There's just not enough of them.
I agree completely. And it's unfortunate, but again, we have watched way worse film from Netflix than this
Absolutely.
One. So if you like sci-fi, you like a little action, I think this one's worth checking out. And I do think the performances are really solid. I'm sad to find out that the lead essentially has passed.
Yeah. And I think she's good. We didn't really mention her, but I think she has a very understated performance. Some
she
could
does.
Say boring, but I think it's very understated and she comes alive when she needs to.
I would say it reflects the like Ryan Gosling 2049 vibe, right? Like it's this dour, not sure where you fit in, dreaded existential type vibe that I think
she's
she does
living
a really
her
good
situation.
Job.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I liked her. I think she's good. I can see people thinking it was a bit boring, but no, I think when she needed to, she rose to the moment when she needed to. And other than that, I quite liked her more subdued performance in comparison to something like Ryu Kyung-soo, who is very big in this film. And that kind of grated me a little bit. And then it's not just him, but you've got there are other things in here. Like you've got this new CEO at one point of the company, just dressed in pink. She turns up, she says things, and then she's never seen again. I'm like, what?
Yeah,
what's that all about? It's just things like that which happen. But I thought
even that interaction felt out of place almost.
It felt like a reshoot, but I don't know if this film went through reshoots. But so I think in her final performance, I think Kang Soo-yeon gave a very good performance. And like you, I think Kim Hyun-joo as Zhang Yi was very affable. I liked her an awful lot. So overall, John, it's solid. If you've got an hour and 40 to burn and you like sci-fi, which goes a little bit dramatic, a little bit action, but doesn't really commit to anything else, you'll probably like this. But do you have anything else you want to add, John?
No. I think if you are into the genres, that you're in for a solid film.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that, my friend. And that seems like a pretty good place to end off our discussion of Zhang Yi. As we mentioned, there won't be a spoiler episode for this film. Let's go check out the film. Let us know what you thought about it, and we'll give those social links at the end of the episode. So let's move on now to our next segment, which we call Chuffed Headlines. Here, John and myself, we grab a movie or pop culture headline that caught our attention, and we share it with the world and discuss it. So, John, what positive, happy story have you gone for this week?
Well, I'm only going to briefly talk about the story because I'm going to use it as a platform. In case listeners, you don't know, Matt and I do another podcast infrequently called Movie Astrology.
There will be more of them.
And it's a limited series in the sense that we can only do as many years as there are movies, right? Like it's got a limited window. Granted, we have a lot of episodes left to do.
We do.
It is time consuming because for us to cover, we have to watch movies of the year that we're covering. But nevertheless, pretty much, what is it, like 1981, the Razzies show up. If you're not familiar, that's the Golden Raspberry Awards. It's somewhere in the 80s. I know that they show up. I don't remember the exact year, but the Golden Raspberries are the anti-Oscars. They are the negative awards. They give the worst movie and the worst thing. And sometimes they've been funny. I can't act like I've never approved of their nominations. But at the same time, the very heart of the awards is nasty. It's mean. It's cruel. It's not nice. It's not, it's not the people are in on the joke vibe. It is always this kind of belittling and condemnation. And it's one of the reasons why when we do our Bampies, we don't do the worst movie of the year. We try to do disappointment, like movies that we were really excited about that let us down versus just outright saying, this is what we think is the worst movie. Because something a lot of film critics say nowadays is no one sets out to make a bad movie. And even if you think something is bad, there's probably someone out there who loves it.
Of course. And we've said now, on astrology as well, just to your point, that mm-hmm. the Razzie Awards, they kind of started as a little bit of fun. You know, it's kind of like the, mm-hmm. the obviously the counterculture, the counter to the Oscars, a little bit of fun. Oh, so Hulk Hogan was bad in Suburban Commando. Let's just give him an award, but not actually have a proper, like a real ceremony. But we've noticed, haven't we? And I know you have, especially that the further we go through astrology, movie astrology, the less funny these Razzies become, or the less lighthearted and the more cynical they become, the more, like you say, mean-spirited, and it seems to have hit a head now.
Yes, and one movie that got a lot of hate last year that Big Tuna and I actually were kind of on board with, it was a better X-Men movie than several of the X-Men movies, was Firestarter, right?
I didn't mind it.
I thought it was solid. Like, I thought Zac Efron was good, and I definitely didn't remember having anything negative to say about its lead, who is Ryan Kiara Armstrong. Yeah. I thought she did well with what was given to her.
Mm-hmm.
And child performances are always tough because they're children.
Yeah.
A lot of times, if anybody deserves the blame for a child's acting, it's either the parents for making their kid do the thing, maybe the casting director for casting a child, but probably more realistically the director, because the director is supposed to get the performance out of the actor. They have to make the kid feel comfortable. You know, like even Stanley Kubrick, who's notoriously a hard ass of a director, supposedly was so kind to the kid on The Shining that the kid didn't even know he was in a horror movie, and he was so protective of him. So I don't know for sure if it's the director's fault. Even more, I don't think anything was wrong with her performance, but the Razzies have maybe gone too far and nominated a 12-year-old girl as worst actress. Now, as a teacher of high school students who actively tries to stop bullying and stop this cruelness, to see adults think it's okay to put them on, like, and I can't sit here and say I've never criticized a child performance. I'm sure I have.
Oh, we've done it on this show, but we're also very aware of the fact that they are a child.
Yes,
we will always be honest and say if a performance isn't up to par, we will always bring it up, but we won't sit here and rag on the performer per se,
or to give them, like, to nominate them for a worst actress. Now, the beauty of this article is the backlash from the internet, for once, I think, it's not that it never does good, but a lot of times the backlash of the internet is a bad phrase. In this case, it's for good, because they rescinded the nomination and said it probably wasn't a good idea is a horrible quote if the headline from the Rolling Stones article is accurate. But I think maybe the lesson to take from this is not that you just shouldn't give a negative award. We just shouldn't have negative awards. Like, it's counterintuitive in the fact that it's an award, right? And no one's trying to be the worst, that we're aware of, at least. And if someone is, cool. But most of the time, it's mean-spirited and thus unnecessary. Like, let's prop up the people who did really well. And, you know, if we have criticisms, because again, we definitely give negative criticisms on this show. I'm not saying there isn't room for that, but it to make fanfare about it. And again, talk about punching down to target a 12-year-old on a movie that did not do well, whether you like it or not, it did not do well. It wasn't like a big blockbuster that we were like, oh, well, clearly, like if they had nominated Jacob Tremblay from The Room, which would have been insane, mind you, but if they had, to do that the year that, like, oh no, The Room is doing really well, everyone's like, he could probably get over it. But like, to it's like kicking someone while they're down. The movie didn't like take off, a lot of people didn't see it, and then to like give her the negative award, it's just like, come on, this has to end. We're already pushing for the Globe stand, but maybe the Razzies just have outstayed their welcome.
Yeah, I mean, look, like you say, we critique films on this podcast, and we do it on our respective websites as well, and on our Letterbox. Sadly, something has to be at the bottom of our yearly ranking, but we don't. I'd like to think we don't make a big song and dance about it. Yeah, sure, we'll mention what we may think was the film that we didn't like during the year, whether it disappointed us or we just didn't like it. There have been films that I've come out here and said, I do not like this film at all. But that's kind of where it ends now. Do you know what I mean? I'd rather focus on the films that I did like. And the Razzies, whilst I admit, in theory, like, it's a bit of fun, that it used to be anyway. it has become mean-spirited and stuff like this. And I think they did the same with Jake Lloyd back in 99 with The Phantom Menace, which, look what happened to Jake Lloyd.
God, yeah, let's not hope. I hope this girl does not follow in those footsteps.
Certainly hope not, because I thought she was fine in the film. And again, like you and Tuna, the triumvirate here, I thought the film was actually fine. It didn't blow me away, but I thought it was solid. The fact that they've had to take a backward step because of the backlash, I think is firstly great that people were willing to stand up enough for this young actress and say, you know, what are you doing? Look at yourselves in the mirror. I think it's good that the Razzie Awards looked at it and thought, okay, maybe we're in the wrong here. But like you said, it shouldn't actually have to get to that point for them to say, oh, we've been found out. Okay. Well, we'll admit we've done something wrong because people have found out and told us. I think you're right, John. I think it's time to wind up, not because we're party poopers or we're boring or we're middle-aged boomers or anything. No, it's just, what's the point? I mean, how many times I've seen it more and more in Twitter and Instagram and things like that recently, John, when any critic, whether it's someone for Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, a YouTuber, or, you know, people who do it for a hobby, whatever, put out a worst of list. There's always people now kind of saying, what are we doing this for? What is the point? Why are we reveling in it? And that's why, like you say, we don't do it. We have our opinions and we will mention it. But I think let's celebrate more so, because as you say, nobody goes out to make a bad film. I mean, you could look at some directors and think, maybe you do, but like, what's the guy who did The Room, or Room, whatever it's called. You could think, are you going out? There's somebody else who makes films like that. They've got like a PowerPoint background. I can't think of his name now, but he's a kind of Tommy Wiseau-esque type bloke. But I mean, even they have faith in what they're doing. So yeah, this is mean-spirited. I'm glad that they've seen the error of their ways, but you got to kind of question how it got to that point in the first place.
Yeah, and the damage is probably done. Like, you can't unannounce it. You know what I'm saying? The announcement's the cruel part. Like, the kid is, she probably saw, like, the kid's been outed now. Worse actress? Like, I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like she'd done much else either. So, like, give her a chance. Like, you've maybe crushed her dreams, especially in the award season where we've heard, oh man, I'm gonna mess up his name. Everything everywhere all at once. Oh my god. Short round. Why can't I think of his name?
Oh, Ki Hui Kwan.
Yes, we've heard him saying how he felt like there was no jobs for him as a child actor. You know, he has these two big movies, Goonies, Temple of Doom, and then nothing. And while his might be tied to his ethnicity, it's still like a child actor's dreams were just kind of like crushed, and he wasn't nominated as worst. You know, like if this was her first movie and she's like, yay, I'm an actress. And then like, well, nah, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's like, God, you say that about like Meryl Streep. Like, no one's saying that about Meryl Streep. That's why I'm picking her. But imagine like if she's nominated for worst actress, Meryl can like brush it off. Like, dude, are you kidding? I've been nominated more than any other actress ever. I don't care that you've nominated me, but then there is the one other thing about the Razzies, though. I forget which award it is, but they nominated something for, I can't remember if it was best or worst actress, and then that same person was nominated, or that same movie is nominated for a best picture or something. I cannot think of what it is.
I know exactly what it is you're talking about and who it is you're talking about, John, because I was going to mention it. Which kind of lends into a nice little segue, I guess, because my headline, you know what it is, guys. You know, we love the Oscars. We love the award season. On the flip side to the Razzies, the Oscars, the Academy Awards, the 95th Academy Award nominations were released last week. We after all the conjecture and speculation, we now know who will be gunning for those awards on March the 12th. And one of those nominations, John, to play into what you've just said, is Ana de Armas for Blonde.
Yes, that's it.
She's up for lead actress, which, getting into that surprised me, because the film, you know, he's, you know, in terms of worst films, blah blah, I didn't like Blonde. I did not like Blonde, and I said the reasons why on the show that we covered it, or in the segment we covered it during that week. Ana de Armas is good in Blonde. I don't think she's excellent in Blonde. And she was up for lead actress, so I was slightly surprised by that. But in the same week, she's also nominated for worst actress at the Razzies.
For the same movie.
For the same film. So, you know, what's up with that? Do you know what I mean? That's where you kind of think, where's the relevance of this? And I know everyone's going to say, well, Halle Berry picked up her award for Catwoman and had a great time. Sandy B, Sandra Bullock, yeah, took it in good
the year
spirit.
She won. She won Best
Exactly.
Actress.
And also
different movie, Sandra though. Bullock. Different movie.
Different movie, but also Sandra Bullock and Halle Berry were 12-year-old kids starting their career at the time. Yep. So they had already had an Oscar behind them or were receiving Oscars that year. So it kind of felt like almost poking fun at the Razzies at the same time or joining in the gag. But the Oscars, though, John, were announced. Everything Everywhere All at Once leads the way with 11 nominations. We knew it would do well at the Oscars. 11 nominations. Right behind that, though, you've got All Quiet on the Western Front and The Banshees of Inisherin, which both got 9 nominations. For me, there was a few surprises in the nominations. A lot's been made of the kind of lack of diversity once more from the Oscars in terms of the directors all being men. I mean, I thought Gina Prince-Bythewood was a shoo-in, or Sarah Polley for Women Talking, but no. And then also in the Best Actress, you know, Danielle Deadwyler, no Viola Davis. And this isn't a case I can already hear the nut job saying, well, you do it based on talent. Maybe you do. But Danielle Deadwyler, but especially for me, Viola Davis was absolutely superb in Norman King. And I'm looking at that Best Actress list now. I'll read it out. Cate Blanchett, shoo-in. Michelle Yeoh, a shoo-in. But then you've got Michelle Williams in Lead Actress for The Fabelmans, which is a brave move on her behalf. But I know you are very much up on her, but I'm taking Michelle Williams out for Viola Davis because I preferred her performance. But this is all subjective.
I could agree with that for sure. And Michelle Williams, while a major character, it is a debated supporting role.
Supporting
to the movie.
Role, yeah. I think you're right, John. Then you've got Ana de Armas in Blonde, which a lot of people have been arguing that she's always been in the race, and she has always been in the race, but I was still very surprised when her name came out. But then you've got, John, Andrea Riseborough for a film called Too Letterly, who in the last month, her performance has seen the most unbelievable campaign online by A-list actors saluting this performance as one of the best they've ever seen and hosting screenings of this film for fellow actors and Academy members to come and watch. And somehow out of nowhere, she's managed to sneak into Lead Actress. Now, I'll get onto that film later on, but I mean, that came out of nowhere, but it has upset a lot of people in terms of the inclusion there. But Best Actor, John, no real surprises except for maybe us. Paul Mescal got in for After Sun, not because he was bad, but I didn't see him sneaking in. I know a lot of people were very excited about that. Best Director, Ruben Östlund for Triangle of Sadness is nominated, alongside Todd Field for Tar, Spielberg, obviously, The Daniels for Everything Everywhere, and McDonough for The Banshees. So I'm not going to go through every category here, John, because they're out there for everyone to see, and I imagine most of our listeners know these, but most categories, not all, seem to have kind of one inclusion where you think, or snub, if you want. I don't like the word snub, but exclusion where you think, oh, that's a surprise. For me, Best Picture, here are the 10, John. The 10 Best Picture nominees, All Quiet on the Western Front, The Banshees, Elvis, Everything Everywhere, The Fabelmans, Tar, Top Gun, Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, Women Talking, and Avatar, The Way of Water. I was floored when Avatar, The Way of Water was named as one of the 10 best pictures. We've said on this show, sometimes, you know, they usually only do 8. Maybe it would sneak in of 9 or 10. I did not think for a second Avatar would be anywhere near that top 10. Which is a surprise, but we've got the two biggest grossing films of the year in there now with Top Gun and Avatar. But with Ruben Östlund's Triangle of Sadness being in the Best Picture, he's also scored a Best Director nom. Sarah Polley didn't get a Best nom for Women Talking. Again, Best Supporting Actor, Brian Tyree Henry got in for Causeway alongside Judd Hirsch for The Fabelmans. And then you got
which I like that
Gleason.
Performance.
I thought it was good. Gleason, Keoghan and Kwan are in as well. Brian Ty Henry, was good to see him get in there again. I wasn't sure he would make it, but he did. And then Best Supporting Actress. This is one that's been getting some contention just because of who has been nominated ahead of who. But Angela Bassett for Black Panther, Wakanda Forever is nominated. Now, I think she was excellent in that film. All of my BAMPY runners-up and winners are actually in this. Hong Chow for The Whale. She was one of my runners-up. Mm-hmm. Kerry Condon. She's great. Kerry Condon for Banters was my other runner-up, and my winner for supporting actress was Stephanie Sue, who is in alongside Jamie Lee Curtis for Best Supporting
Which
Actress.
Is cool.
Yeah, a lot of people were kind of surprised that Jamie Lee Curtis was in the running and being spoken about more so than Stephanie Sue, but at the end of the day, they both got in there, so everybody's a winner. And I love that Banshees, the ensemble, got nominated, and same for Everything Everywhere. All of those kind of major players got nominated, which is really cool to see. Other than that, the only other kind of big problem for me, sadness, was Decision to Leave just got nothing, absolutely nothing, which is a huge surprise. Yeah. And The Woman King didn't get anything, which is a huge surprise. But hey, look, no, these are never going to be perfect, John. They're never going to be a catch-all for everybody. But you've seen the nominations, dude. Was there anything which you thought should or shouldn't have been in, which was or wasn't?
When they first dropped, you text me, and it's like, was there any snubs? And I was like, no. And then, and not necessarily snubs, like you said, but there's so many movies, right? So like my brain didn't initially register. And then I was like, oh, wait, because The Woman King, when I saw it, reminded me of Braveheart in its scale and storytelling. And even in like these were some big performances. I just thought everyone was so good in The Woman King, and Jennifer Bythewood comes out just swinging with this huge epic, right?
Costume production Netflix movie. As well.
Yeah, and so I expected that, and I kind of, maybe this is what happened, is that it was at a week, it came out like September, I think, right? Like it was a few months ago. I really like that movie. I'm surprised it. I feel like a lot of people didn't see it in general, and I wonder if maybe that even happened with the Academy, because it was an epic. I think it was just at 3 hours or just under 3 hours.
Yep.
But I loved every minute of it. I was really into that. I liked Elvis, and I like Baz Luhrmann. I am surprised that it's nominated for Best Picture, because that one felt like a lot of people were like, you know, poo-pooing it. Like, Austin Butler, yes, everyone was talking about his performance, but like, yep. Hanks is nominated for a Razzie. Obviously, it doesn't mean anything, but
yeah,
people were talking not great things about that performance. I didn't mind it, but it was undeniably a distracting performance from Hanks. Right? Yeah, like, it's a very performance. But he's not the showcase. But still, I didn't feel like people were loving the movie enough to get it as a Best Picture. Avatar was nominated for Best Picture also, so like, it doesn't surprise me. James Cameron he's one of those like blue collar success stories. Like, he's not the traditional route to film.
Yes,
he has revolutionized cinema in every major movie that he's releasing. And to be fair, barely releases movies. So every movie pretty much at this point he has released in the last 30 years has changed the way movies are made.
This damn film's made over $2 billion. It's a film which nobody wanted to see, apparently, which I've been guilty of kind of thinking, Avatar 2, it's made over $2 billion, John.
And that's the thing about women talking that is so cool that it's in here, is that is the epitome of a low-budget film. It is nine to 10 actors in a room talking for most of the movie. Great performances, tremendous performances, and yet none of them are represented anywhere, and that's upsetting too, that you have this important story and you're not getting nominations from anyone, right? Like, I don't think, am I missing, like, Jesse Buckley not nominated?
Yeah, no, nothing at all. Jesse Buckley absolutely should have been on there.
And it is a movie I feel is like barely seen. So it's exciting that it's on the list. But like you said, then to not include Sarah Polley on the director's list is a little jarring to me. But yeah, overall, the one thing I want to bring up is, listeners, if you don't watch the Oscars, you may not know this, but the five original songs get performed during the ceremony.
Yes.
And how they perform those songs vary. Sometimes it is the original artist. Sometimes it's they get other celebrities involved. It mixes up. It's always a big part of the presentation of the night, because it breaks up the monotony of, and the award goes to, right? Like, we get these musical interludes that eventually will lead to the announcement of who wins the Best Original Song. This year, and I'm sure it's happened before, but it definitely doesn't happen all the time, we have an international film's song. An international film that somehow is snubbed. And I do think it's snubbed, because I don't know if there's ever been a international film seen by as many Americans as RRR prior to the nominations being announced, right? Like, 'cause that's usually when Americans start to care about the international genre, like art, like designation is once they've announced the five, then movie people start going, oh, I guess I should try to watch these.
Yeah, this thing blew up.
RRR was a blockbuster level Netflix movie. Now, it did have a theatrical run, but that's not where it blew up. It blew up on Netflix.
Yep.
People were talking about it all year. And the song Natu Natu is nominated for Best Original Song. And
I knew you'd love that.
So hyped to see the performance of that song. I don't know how they're going to do it. If there isn't choreographed suspender movements, I will be disappointed.
You know they're going to go all out. They have to.
I hope they do. I'm so excited to see how that goes.
Yeah, I mean, best song. I mean, look, you're going to have Diane Warren singing. You're going to have Lady Gaga. You're going to have Rihanna. You're going to have Natu Natu blowing the place up. You're going to have Mitski on stage. It ain't a bad lineup of songs to be, or artists to be checking out. I'm like you say, there's a few surprises here and there. Do I wish something like Decision to Leave had gotten any love? Yeah, I do. I do think that was, that's a grossly snubbed film, if you will.
Both of our cinematographer winners is not even acknowledged as a best picture.
It's like, not even in the best international film, which again is fine because I haven't seen all the international films and they may be better. But for me, that film was excellent. And in terms of directing, Adrina Prince-Bythewood and Sarah Polley, for the most part, have been fairly semi-vocal online about missing out and the consequences of such or what kind of precedence it sets, which sometimes I agree with, sometimes I don't agree with, you know, directors or actors coming out, because kind of then I start to think, what was the motivation behind making the film? Was it to tell the story, or was it to get an award? Or was it a bit of both? I'm not saying those two are falling into any negative category, but they have been getting, they have been online talking about the, you know, what it means to miss out to them and to, other people involved. So go check them out. They are interesting reads, though. But yeah, Oscars, though, John, March the 12th, the ceremony is Sunday, March the 12th. We are going to find out who wins, who loses. I have literally got one question for you, though, John. I was going to mention it during it, but I got so swept up with what you're saying. You mentioned Austin Butler. Do you think that's going to be the surprise of the night? Can you see him topping Colin Farrell or Brendan Fraser? Because something in the back of my head is telling me, I think he might win. I'm not going to put any money on it, but there's something in the back of my mind.
I mean, he is playing a beloved historical figure. People love Elvis. So it's possible. I don't know, man. I feel like Brendan Fraser is a likely win, but I don't know. I don't know, because The Whale got no other love, really. I mean,
I think you've got makeup, I think.
Yeah, which obviously, I mean, that's going to happen. Yeah. But like, it, you know, Aronofsky's not there, and he's been nominated a few times. His movies are always a little edgy, but he's been nominated. Yep. And I thought The Whale might sneak in because of that, but nope. He was not on that list. So I don't know. Elvis is, and that is the curveball, right? Like that movie's nominated for Best Picture. Maybe that's why, because they are like, we want to justify him winning the award. So like, it's not just his performance. The movie's excellent. It's nominated. Yeah. It's one of our 10 nominees, but it's because of this guy. This is the reason, you know? So maybe it's definitely a possibility.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out in a few weeks' time, JB. So that's the Oscars and the Razzies then for this year. Let's move on to media consumption now, which is our segment where we discuss all the media we've been consuming since the last episode. So movies, TV shows, video games, music, podcasts, which aren't ours, anything we've done to pass time since the last show. So JB, what you been checking out?
Well, Blank Check just did the Shallow Grave episode. So we've started the Danny Boyle series. So I listened to that. Very, very good first episode. It's just the guys, no guests on that one. All fans of Shallow Grave, which I really like that movie a lot. I'm glad I own it on Criterion. I beat God of War from 2018. Immediately had to buy God of War Ragnarok. I did get it for PS4 instead of spending the extra money to get a PS5. I am working my way through that game. It is, man, just so compelled. I don't know why I didn't click with the game when I first bought it. But I'm kind of glad I didn't, because now I get to jump right into the sequel instead of having to wait 4 years. So advantage me. And then for movies, I've been playing God of War, so I haven't been watching as many movies. But I did go see Missing, which I can't wait for you to get to see, but that would have been our episode this week, but it wasn't released in the UK on time. I love Searching. I've taught Searching. I think I even mentioned that maybe on the last episode. I think Missing is a maybe better story, but it's hard to top John Cho's performance. John Cho is just so great.
He's great.
But no criticism to the actors in this movie. Storm Reid, I think, does a really good job. But I think even how this is a spiritual sequel, not a direct sequel, I think there's some really cool nods to Searching that someone like myself who's watched it too many times probably will pick up on and really, really, and like I was enjoying those things.
That's cool, though.
Then it's Sundance right now.
Yes.
And while I am not a Sundance critic, nor did I apply to be, because I'm a realist. I don't have that kind of pull to be on that list. But I did buy some tickets. I've watched two of the four movies that I'm watching from Sundance because it is virtual again. I think something that the one positive of the pandemic is it made film festivals figure out ways to do things online. And I like getting to see things. So I saw Shortcomings, which is the Randall Park directorial debut. I hope that's right. I hope I didn't just screw up who it is. I liked it. I didn't love it. But partly because the lead character is, he is a bit obnoxious. But he's supposed to be. It is Randall Park. I didn't mess that up. Yay me. And not the performance. I think Justin H. Min does a terrific job. But man, is that character unlikable. So it's very, very hard. Fans of Crazy Rich Asians will also probably take offense to the opening of this movie as it bashes that movie, or more like maybe bashes its success. But I think what the movie's saying is positive, and it's got some laughs in it. It wasn't. I was really expecting like a 5-star kind of rom-com, and it's more of like a 3-star. And then I caught this kind of like tone poem called "All Dirt Roads Lead to Salt." It's produced by Barry Jenkins, which is why it was recommended to me, because I'm a big Barry Jenkins fan. I need the guy to make some movies, because I know he did a show, and I haven't watched the series that he did, but I would love a Barry Jenkins movie to come out. All Dirt Roads, Taste of Salt. I got to say, one of the things, the downside of Sundance at Home is I am distracted. I was definitely distracted the last couple of days. It's been a hectic week, and But I bought the tickets in advance. So like I got to watch the movies when I can. So I'm like, I know going in, I'm like, I'm not in the mood to watch a movie. But this movie, despite that, I definitely didn't give it my full attention. But the fact that it wasn't a narrative in the traditional sense, that it's not cramming a story or plot down your throat, it's just these kind of sequences and they're emotionally connected. It kind of hit the right vibe for me while I was watching it, where I was just like, this is kind of what I need. It's like, I can look up at it. I can feel it. Even if I'm not really connecting all of the dots, you don't have to for you to get the vibe. And yeah. I kind of liked that part of it. Honestly, if I was watching it with 100% of my attention, I might've been more irritated the fact that it isn't a traditional narrative. But because I was doing some other stuff while I was watching it, I kind of think that it just hit right for me. So, overall, positive on the two films I've watched. I have two more to watch later in the week from nice. Sundance.
Nice.
And then the last thing, I waited because I know you also watch this. I forgot on Sunday night that the second episode of Last of Us came out, but remembered on Monday, managed to avoid spoilers and did watch the episode. And man, it's making me want to replay the games because I love the character so much. And Pedro Pascal, guys, give him all the roles. I love watching him. He's so charismatic, and he just, no matter what he's doing, it's just like, I can't stop watching him when he's on screen.
Yeah. We've said, I've spoken about this as well, that something like The Last of Us really shows what Pedro Pascal can do compared to The Mandalorian, which he's obviously the star of, but probably spends about couple of hours each year on set or in the booth doing the voice of. This is a vehicle for Pedro Pascal to show just how good he is, and this is only episode 2, John. What was your kind of reaction to the episode? Because the first episode to me was damn near flawless, and the second one, whilst, you know, if the first one was a 10 out of 10, the second one to me was a 9 out of 10. It was I thought it was really good.
I agree. I had no major issues. I thought that we got to see some really cool stuff. I played the first game when it came out. I had to do some reading because I was like, wait, I don't remember if what happens in the game. And I won't say for spoiler reasons either way, but I was like, I needed to kind of read up to like, wait, how did this play out in the game? Oh yeah. Okay. I remember that. But like, it didn't just come to me.
Yeah. The series changes a few things up, and all the changes so far from the first two episodes, I think have been justified and have actually worked better in this medium. Remember, it's an adaptation. It's not to the world. It's an adaptation. It's not a straight up remake. So there will be things that they change. I'm just can't wait for John to watch the next episode. And hopefully when we talk about that next week, I cannot wait for that. But yeah, show goes from strength to strength. I haven't really been doing as much the last week, John, because I have had the worst migraines for the last few days, which make me not want to do anything. But I've been watching a few things and I've been listening to a few things. I listened to the Dead Meat podcast because they discussed Pearl. And speaking of Oscar omissions, we knew it was never going to happen. We knew not in a million years of Sundays and a million Oscar ceremonies was Mia Goff ever going to be nominated, because horror, just because she should have been up in that damn Best Actress nomination for that monologue in Pearl, if anything. But so I listened to them discuss Pearl. I watched the last episode too, thought it was really good. I've been playing Ghostwire Tokyo on PS5. I mentioned this last week that I'd got it on a rental, and I'm enjoying it. Like I mentioned in the bloody awesome section last week, I want to play stuff which I wouldn't usually play. I've got so stuck in my ways of playing the new Star Wars game when it comes out, or playing a sports game like FIFA or NHL, and then, you know, then playing something like The Last of Us when it comes out, something which I feel like I have an attachment with, and then just not playing anything, having this console, just not playing games because, well, it hasn't got a lightsaber or it hasn't got Joel in it or whatever. So I'm like, no, I've got this rental scheme. I'm going to stop renting games which maybe I wouldn't play, not because I don't like the premise of them, but I don't know why. I'm a funny, funny creature of habit. Again, I've got to have a connection to get into it. But I was like, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get Ghostwire Tokyo. Got that on rent. The Tango Gameworks Bethesda game. I'm enjoying it so far. I've only played an hour, a couple of hours, but I'm enjoying it. It's a first-person game, and it's you go through Tokyo, funnily enough, and you have to kind of use magic and karate to take down these spirits and ghosts that are haunting Tokyo. And I'm enjoying it so far. I think the gameplay, the mechanics are good. Maybe they could be expanded on somewhat, but so far I'm enjoying it. It looks as good as you'd imagine. And hopefully by this time next week, I'll be able to give a slightly more in-depth, spoiler-free review of it. But no, I'm quite pleased that stepping out of my comfort zone and getting new games for a console I paid hundreds and hundreds of dollars and pounds for.
Yeah.
Use a damn thing. And lastly, John, I mentioned that Andrea Riseborough has been nominated for Best Actress. This film's come out of nowhere. To Leslie, it's called. Come out of nowhere. You know, no one was talking about it last year. Maybe those who saw it on the film festival circuit were, but let's face it, I hadn't heard of this film. I don't know if you had, John. I hadn't heard of this film until about a month ago.
Which is odd. That sounds right.
It's Andrea Riseborough. It's Allison Janney. Mark Maron's in it as well, and he's very good in this. You know, it's not like it's an indie film. Like, we were talking about low budget indie. This has all of the hallmarks of a low budget indie film. And, you know, I watched it out of curiosity. I was like, is Andrea Riseborough that good? What's the film like, is it any good? It's available to rent if you've got £3 or $4 to drop. You can get it on, I think an Apple, or I can't even remember where I rented it from now. Prime, maybe? It's somewhere. But just Google it, you'll find out where to get it from. It's about £3 or £4. But I watched it, and it's a good film, actually. I quite enjoyed it. It's about a Texan mother. She's a single mother in Texas, played by the very English Andrea Riseborough, who wins the lottery. This is all part of the synopsis. She wins the lottery, but then squanders it all away. And at the same time, she's been struggling to provide for her son, a teenage son. And it's more about her story when she's hit the bottom, basically. And Mark Maron plays a manager, like a hotel manager, motel manager, who kind of takes her in, tries to help her out somewhat. But Andrea Riseborough, she is excellent in this. She is really, really very good in this film, very good. But Mark Maron, surprisingly, is really damn good in this as well. Like, really good.
like him anyways, but Sword of Trust is a movie not enough people have seen, and I think he is so good in. If you, it's got also Jillian Bell, who I'm not always a fan of, but I really like her in that movie as, and if you can watch that, it's also, it's directed by Lynn Shelton, and
yes,
and she, you know, she passed away in 2020, so it was, it's her last movie. I think it was her last movie. I don't know if something came out after that, but highly recommend if you thought he was good in this. I know I haven't seen it, so he might be better in To Leslie.
I think,
but
he's
just a Sword of Trust. He's just so good in, and it, it's his movie. Like, he's the lead in that. I just think he's excellent.
He kind of flies under the radar, doesn't he, for his acting? Because obviously he's got the WTF podcast, which is good in fits and starts. I quite enjoy it, but other than his annoying tendencies on air, but which we've mentioned a few times. But he is a very, very, very capable actor, and he's great in that, and he's great in this. And yeah, the film, this film's like the real kind of humanity to this film. It's not poking fun at kind of alcoholism or abuse or anything like that. The film actually kind of scoops it up and, like I say, with a lot of humanity, shows this story. And the character, Andrea Riseborough's character, she's fully developed in this. It's not just a, you know, a person, you know, a single Texan mother who's struggling, so we'll just have montages of her drinking out of a vodka bottle or something. No, it's not a surface level of that. This is, really goes deep, and I think this is a really good film, and having watched it, I get why Andrea Riseborough has been nominated. I'm just surprised that there was no just mention before. There was this kind of odd celebrity clamour, which I haven't really seen before. And that has also raised the ire of people who, you know, studios pour millions into these campaigns to get their actors nominated. And all it took was, you know, a call to a couple of your A-list mates to tweet about it, an Instagram message about it, with suspiciously all tweeting the same text as well. But hey, look, it's worked. But the performance does back it up. I will say that the performance does back it up. So yeah, go check it out. It's available. It's available to rent. Like I say, it's about £3-4 to rent. And if I don't know when it's coming out. If it's going to be on any streaming services, I'm going to pick it up to stream. But Amazon Prime has got it for like £3.50. Apple TV does have it. So check it out. I would recommend checking it out, John. But
it's on the list for sure.
Yeah. So that's everything I've been checking out this week. Looking forward to talking about The Last of Us next week, JB. However, before then, we have to remind everyone that we love doing this show. We've been doing it for, I think this is the sixth year, I think, now that the show has been in existence. It's bloody awesome, isn't it? But we need to stay bloody awesome. For 6 years, we've been staying bloody awesome. But week to week, we've got to find new ways to do so. So, John, how have you been staying bloody awesome in the last week?
Well, I got to be a guest at a wedding, and it was a big wedding because it was a co-worker's wedding, but a friend and a former student, she is. I got to, my wife and I went to her wedding on Saturday. Love her and her husband, and it was great. It was one of the nicest weddings I've been to in my life, especially as my adult life. Like, when I was a kid, I got to go to like family friend weddings all the time, and they were always really nice. And then I think our generation, it got too expensive, or maybe our parents didn't have money to pay for it. And I just, everybody I know who's gotten married have had relatively small affairs, maybe even just family only, or it's like a reception at their house, that kind of thing. This was like a more traditional wedding. Still wasn't, it was like an outdoors wedding ceremony place, but it was still like, you know, there was a reception. We had a big tent. The food was quite good. The desserts were very good. Although I gotta say, some of the guests at the wedding don't know proper protocol. Like, the dessert table was out immediately after the ceremony, but you weren't supposed to go to it. Like, it was like cocktail hour and like, you know, hors d'oeuvres, and people were just snatching like the desserts, man, where like we didn't get to try everything, which is okay, but the stuff we did have was real good. And it was,
I always
just a good
ask
time
about the food. I'll always ask about the food at weddings.
Oh yeah. I think it's, is it chicken satay or satay? Dude, I've never had that before.
This good stuff, and isn't it?
It was so good, dude. I wish I could have got a few more of those chicken
over
on a
here.
Stick.
We love it.
Yeah, super good. But yeah, good. It was a good time. Got to met some new people. There were, it was formal, like tables where we had place settings kind of thing. And my coworker knows me well enough. She put us with other teachers, a few I work with, but a few from others, like other schools that she went to college with. They are now teachers.
Nice.
And they were all really cool. It was a really good time. My wife and I had a blast, and had, like I said, we hadn't been out like at a big social gathering like that really since the pandemic. So it was nice getting back out and talking to people and connecting and stuff.
That sounds awesome. And you and I are both the same in that sometimes we quite like the sanctity of our own four walls, and going out into the big wide world for a social event can sometimes be like, ah, okay. But when you get there, we usually have a good time. But so I'm glad to hear that you and your wife had a blast, and also that the ceremony was a beautiful one. So congratulations to the happy couple. Next time, hopefully they're not next time for them. Next time you have a wedding invite, where's mine? Yeah. I'll be the plus three.
Yeah, yeah. Try
some American food, dude. Mine is slightly less bombastic and slightly less food oriented as well, but it's no less cool. Audiobooks, John. I do love an audiobook, but I fall in and out of love with them because I don't know about you. And when I listen to one, I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but I have to be in, or else before I know it, 5 minutes has gone past and I've missed out the last five minutes because I've been working, concentrating on the road, or doing stuff around the house or whatever. I really have to focus, but because I've just been bedridden is the wrong thing to say, but kind of chilling out, laying in a darkened room with a hood up, trying to keep the sun and light out of my eyes to rest my old head, I'm thinking, what can I do? I don't really, sometimes, like I said, I don't want to watch TV because flashing lights and that. I don't really want to stare at my phone because I want to be at a, who does? So I was like, what can I do to pass the time? And there's only so many podcasts I can listen to because there's only so many I do listen to, despite John keep telling me, which I will one day hold him up to and listen to the ones he tells me to. But I was like, you know what? I fancy listening to some audiobooks because I have an Audible account, but I paused it recently because I was paying £8 a month and not actually using it. So I've probably given them about £100 in the last year for nothing. So I went on there and I had a few free credits, I realised. So I downloaded some audiobooks. Obviously, I got some Star Wars ones because I've read the books because we get them sent to us. So I read them. So knowing the story, I feel like I could listen to them, enjoy them, not worry too much if I miss a few bits. So I blasted through the one called Aftermath, which is a Chuck Wendig book, which is actually the first canon novel released since Disney took over alongside Lost Stars. To read it, it's quite painful because the way it's written isn't great, but to listen to it is very good. But I also downloaded things like The Lord of the Rings and Stephen King's It. I mean, I've read that book. That book is a tome. You could use it as a foundation for your house. But I really, really enjoy listening to audiobooks when I'm in that kind of zone because you get so much out of it. Plus, when they've got good production, when they've got music, they've got sound effects. Really adds to it. So I've been listening to a lot more audiobooks, which is why my film and TV consumption has been down this week. I also watched a few episodes of The Book of Boba Fett as well, because we spoke about it on Star Wars Sessions this week. How do we feel about it a year later? when I rewatched the show, I thought I could really see the problems of this show. I really enjoy it, but goddamn, is it disjointed, and did they shoot themselves in the foot with two Mando episodes? And also, like we said, January is quite a lean month for films coming out at this point. We're going to start kicking off with more and more films coming out in February and March. But, you know, there's been no real reason to jump out and go to the theatre because there's not that much out. There isn't really an awful lot dropping on streaming. I was like, well, now's the time to sit back and enjoy some audiobooks. And I'm having a bloody awesome time doing so, John.
Indeed, sir.
Right, well, that is going to be our episode this week for Zhang Yi. Like we said, we thought it was pretty good. It was fine. No spoiler episode, though, so we're going to be back again next week with our review of a film called Millennium Bugs, which is going to be dropping on VOD. It's going to be dropping on iTunes and many more. John, Millennium Bugs, where's this come from? I'll let you explain.
So a few years ago on Top 5 Movies, one of my old podcasts at Burke Reviews Movie Club and Burke Reviews podcast, depending on how it's queued up there, I had Alejandro Montoya Marin. Oh boy, I hope I got that right. I've said his name a million times. For some reason, I just stuttered through it. Alejandro had reached out to me to cover his first feature that debuted at South by Southwest and was a part of the Rebel Without a Film Crew TV series on the Robert Rodriguez's
El Mariachi.
El Mariachi's movie. He has a TV network here. It's L something. I'm going to forget a TV series, but it was the Rebel Without a Crew was on that series. It was also on the internet. You can watch it. I think you can watch it now. It's a really good series that he took, I think, six directors or five directors, and each one got to make a feature film at the same budget as El Mariachi. Alejandro's was called Monday. I really like Monday.
I saw that too.
In fact, there's a graphic novel called Tuesday that is the sequel to Monday that you can get on Amazon that Alejandro wrote, which I also own. So I am, and he was on an episode of Top 5 Movies after I reviewed Monday. And full disclosure, I've taught Monday once, and he did a impromptu Skype Q&A with my class. So Alejandro, I'd like to say he's a friend, acquaintance for sure, but definitely a friend. And we are going to be reviewing this movie. And full disclosure, I've seen Millennium Bugs before and already know I like it going in, but haven't seen it in a while. So I'm looking forward to rewatching it and giving a formal podcast review about it. But just know there is definitely a little bias on my part. I don't know a lot of directors, and he's been a really cool friend over the years on the internet. We all social. I've never met him in person, even though he was in my backyard one day and I didn't know it and we just missed each other. But I think he's a really talented filmmaker, and I'd love to help people find out his movies exist, because I really do think they're good. Like, it's not just because he's not the only film from that show that I saw. I do think it's the best one that I've seen, without getting into which other ones I've saw. And I think, I like fostering that ability. I want people to know about his movie so that he gets an opportunity to make it bigger and better, because he's got big vision, and he's managed to execute with very little budgets some really top quality stuff. And I'm excited that Millennium Bugs is getting a release that people can see it.
Yes, we're going to be talking about it next week. I also saw Monday and enjoyed it a lot as well. I remember, I think it was he via Big Tuna got it for me, and I enjoyed Monday. Now, I haven't seen Millennium Bugs. Maybe I'll hate it. Maybe I'll love it. Either way, we're going to be discussing it next week on the show. So tune in for that, please do. But if you want to talk to us about Zhang Yi, Millennium Bugs, or any other film in the world, you can find us online. If you go to Twitter and find us at BAMP_podcast, BAMP_podcast. John, where can I find us on Instagram?
At Bloody Awesome Movie Pod.
Yes, sir. We're also on Facebook if you're on there as well. If you look on the tomato meter for Zhang Yi this week, you will also see that the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast will have put up a review for that film, or a rating, shall we say. So we'll be contributing to the tomato meter, as we will each week, being an RT approved publication. You can find us also individually online. You can find me whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. Search What I Watch Tonight across all the social medias and Letterboxd. And John, where on earth are you in the world?
I'm at BurkReviews.com and at BurkReviews on all the social media platforms.
Okay, go and rate and review us if you like what we're doing here. We certainly hope you do. Those 5 stars really would help the show grow. It would get more listeners in. It would bump us up the algorithm and the ranking lists. Plus, we just like knowing there's more film fans out there for us to talk to each week. But with that, as always, stay bloody awesome.
And keep watching movies. Blood, 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 bloody. 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 Blood, bloody, awesome. Blood, 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 bloody, blood, 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 bloody.